Section 8 of Christmas Comes But Once a Year by John Layton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. During the last hour, Cook and John have held a soirée below to all the neighbouring domestics, who are awaiting to escort home their little masters and mistresses. They are regaling upon ale and sandwiches in the servants' hall, whilst that most interesting topic, everybody's business, is being discussed. Mrs. Pest's maid assuring all, upon her sacred word and honour, that Mrs. Pest is not an angel, or the Pest house a paradise, though it may look pretty over the garden wall. And, moreover, Mrs. P's maid said she were of opinion the public knowed it too, for t'other night someone painted out the fust letters agin our doorpost, making the direction at the corner of the lane, Placid Vale, read Acid Ale instead. No compliment, as the maid said, to Mr. Pest, Pewter and Co.'s entire, at the same time observing that it sarved 'em right. And, as I hope afore next Easter to lose my Blessed Virgin Mary name, I'd go. If it weren't for the pale ale Tory circumstances, I'd warn Mrs. It was only yesterday, just after Mr. Pest had gone to Brewhouse in Licorice Street, that we had a scrimmage about flounces, and just as I was a-going to fling my resignation at her, tendin' to go out every evening till the month was up, in a gown 'zactly like Mrs. Hone, lilac with 7 flounces. Well, just when I was on the point of naming the word, I think to little Ned Pest, and as I loved the dear little fellow more than a paltry frock, I consented to stay. Here the gardening groom at the snuggery opposite grinned and winked horribly, observing something about little Ned's being a surfeit of finery, finery that had to be shown and aired, airing begetting the society of Auburn Viscers and Officer X, 50 officers, making Mr. Snuggery chuckle amazingly and grin more, observing officers to be all the kick now, at the same time jerking his thumb in the direction of the party wall and the Albert, saying he knew the captain, met Boltoff at Bath, where he stayed last season, until the waters were too hot, when he dried up. We suppose by drying up the snuggery meant departed. No one appeared to notice the different name applied to the captain, or if they did, said nothing, except Cook, who observed her master and the captain to be as thick as soup, that she thought the former green and soft as overdone spinach, for the captain cut it very fat at master's spence. The governor ought to save his bacon afore he be done to rags. If missus had come in for all the grizzle, she, Cook, said she would not stew and fry herself about it. Poor John, now fully assured of the captain's intention, is very uncomfortable indeed, experiencing the combined sensations of goose-skin, fever, pins and needles, live blood and intoxication, sensations that might have been relieved could they have vanished in the extremities of his hair, but unfortunately that would not stand erect, so plastered and powdered had it been since the captain's arrival. John ruminates upon what has been said, intending to mention the unmentionables and break the awful mystery to Mr. Brown that very night. Now, you must know Mr. Brown and his friend, the captain, condescended to grace the juvenile party. They sat at an occasional table in the recess, drinking wine as if for a wager, trying to dispose of all the surplus decanted yesterday, So you may suppose when John appeared with a melancholy face to impart melancholy news, Mr. Brown was too far gone to comprehend it. That night he could not stand, much more understand. Though somehow, under the inspiration of a draught of water and a damp towel, the diary was made up, as if by instinct.
"January 5th, Saturday. Christmas is dead. Expired with the juvenile party. We have economically disposed of the scraps. A merry Christmas. All the ill luck came upon Fridays. We can have no more this season. Altogether a jolly Christmas with a jolly friend, who is to prove himself a capital one tomorrow. Owes me £350, bill due Monday. Says he will clear off all by then. If money is said to be a friend, what must a friend with money be? A golden treasure, doubly dear. A companion that can never be a drag, because too well off."
Thus closes the Christmas portion of the Brown Diary, its author, as customary on Saturday, dyeing his hair before retiring to rest. But somehow, that eventful evening, Brown could not repose in peace. He abused his best friends in sleep, dreaming the decamps capable of decamping after the bridal breakfast with the dowry across the sea, leaving Jemima and Angelina married vestals, to make more money and fresh conquests in Virginia or Maryland, whither old Brown feels bound to follow in his nightshirt, but is incapacitated, being tied to the earth by a pigtail springing from the organs of amativeness, philoprogenitiveness, inhabitiveness, and adhesiveness. So exciting is Brown's dream that he fancies the decamps escaping. Now the banging door of the Albert fairly awakening the sleeper, who, on attempting to rise, finds the pillow really a fixture to the back of his head, which he tears away in a rage, causing all the pleasing sensations that might be experienced on the removal of a tail by the roots. Brown rushes wildly to the window, opening the casement, and upon looking into the pitch-dark night, he receives a blow from without that causes him to stagger and reel backwards, falling to the floor with a noise that makes Mrs. Brown rise in a fright, obtain a light, and severely reprimand her lord as a drunken fool capable of any wild fancy. The naked truth stands thus. Poor Brown has mistaken a bottle of gum for hair dye and a closet for the casement, bruising his forehead against the shelf. So he creeps back to bed, there to lie moralizing upon cause and effect, thinking how trifling things in themselves may lead to disastrous consequences, reflecting upon the rival bottles, one black, all deceit, the other white and trusty.
"Be not precipitate, nor trust to appearances only, lest you be deceived."
A maxim, Brown fears, he cannot apply to the captain, for never did he know less of a man of whom he ought to have known more. The 5th of January seemed to Brown as if it would never dawn. The bump that took away and restored his senses, or rather sobered that gentleman, feels like an egg placed in the centre of his forehead. He longs for daylight to examine it, daylight that comes and reduces the egg to a walnut shell. Poor Brown's hat will not go on for the excrescence, so he cannot go to church. At breakfast he recounts his dream, which is voted fudge by Mama, stuff by Angelina, and rubbish by Jemima, for they are in no very good humour after the excitement of last week. Little Tom is in bed, having broken his fast upon jalap, administered to counteract the baneful effects of the sweets consumed yesterday, the youth being full as a sack of sand. And, we think, could an anatomist have given a section of the different strata of food that body contained, in the spirit of a geologist, he would have presented a remarkable series of deposits. But away with scientific speculations, to the Browns, who are at breakfast. A meal that has been intruded upon by John, who has recounted enough of a certain story to put Jemima in hysterics, and Angelina in a fainting fit, bringing down a hurricane of abuse upon him. John, the impertinent menial! John, the venomous viper that has recoiled upon its benefactor! John, the dark villain that has plotted with the unworthy man Spoof, who, of course, out of mere envy, mere spite, mere jealousy, would try to overturn that harmony that is not to be broken so easily, that unity that is not to be severed, no, not for 100 Spoofs. Go, go, sir, to your fiddling garret friend. Go and blow his hurdy-gurdy. Go, sir. Tell him the affections of innocent females are not to be played upon like a base vile. Tell him there are ears to pull, horsewhips to be had, aye, and noble gentlemen ever ready to lay on in defence of those scandalously reviled. You may tremble, sir, for menials can be discharged, and have characters to lose. Sir, I give you warning. Sir, you may go. Go, sir. Now, this is the very thing John much wished to do. He had been imperceptibly backing for the last 5 minutes towards the door, fearing to turn tail upon the enemy, the choleric Mr. and Mrs. Brown, who appeared in their very fierceness to counteract each other's fire, each pulling the other back, seeming to get more and more ferocious the nearer their victim gained the door. For when the baited John reached it, he turned the handle of the lock behind him, still facing his antagonists, intending to escape by a side lurch. But just at that critical point, there came a knock of great importance at the outer door, as if the chimney were on fire, or a baby half out of window. The enemy fell back. John opened the door, and lo, there discovered an officer of the police force who wanted a word with John Brown. John, feeling himself the Brown wanted, retreats into the kitchen, where he faints away in a plate basket and stops the Dutch clock. The police officer has had his word, or rather word of words, with Mr. Brown. News said to be important, but of the wildest and most improbable character. News appearing to that gentleman beyond all belief. News that he will not, cannot put faith in. Allegations so preposterous that they may be disproved in a moment. Captain de Camp, alias Boltoff, etc., etc., and 3 other persons, names unknown, now incarcerated in Dover jail for the robbery of John Brown of Mislington. A mistake! A foul plot! A base fiction! At least so thought the worthy gentleman, who was as ignorant of any wrong done him as the lunatic that resides in the moon. Had the sea-serpent been discovered in the back pond, a gold-mine been found in the dustbin, or a sphinx and centaur been captured in Lincoln's Inn Fields, Mr. Brown could not have been more astounded. He knows it to be an imputation that can be disproved in a twinkling, if Mr. Police Inspector will just step next door with him.
But, alas, there the fox's tail is left in the trap. The skirt of the very coat borrowed of Mr. Brown a fortnight since hangs in the door, the very door that slammed when the affrighted gentleman awoke in a dream last night. The concluding facts of these eventful 16 days are simply as follows. To Mr. Spoef is the issue due. He was bound to spend the Sabbath at Canterbury with the cathedral and organ. Upon the journey thither, he happened to recognize some fellow travellers, better known to him than he was to them. From a slight conversation that transpired, he learned their destination to be Boulogne, or rather Dover. So he stopped at Ashford, telegraphing their persons to Dover, where, upon arrival, they were provided with lodging free of expense. From that place, news was instantly sent to Mislington. Little did Mr. Brown think that morning, as he combed out his matted, gummy locks, that his friend Captain de Camp had lost his under the cruel shears in Dover jail. Captain de Camp, as you may suppose, after these lucky stars, again entered upon foreign service, being ordered to New South Wales for 14 years. He sailed in the same transport with his 2 sons. Lady Lucretia stayed at home, leading a very retired life. She resided in a vast mansion at the West End, a castle at Millbank. Mr. Spoef, of course, taking advantage of his rival's absence, wins upon Miss Jemima Brown, in the end marrying her to live happy ever afterwards? No, such was not the case. Mr. Spoef espoused Miss Cecilia Lark, who blessed him with a large family and everything else that woman can. Spoef's means have increased annually with his family. All are musical, and the eldest girl is to be an English lark that will surpass the Swedish nightingale or any other foreign bird. The continentalists attribute it to the southern origin of her papa, and accordingly claim Cecilia Spoef as their own. The Misses Brown still remain open to offers, and are reported to be well worth having. Mr. John Brown, Jr. is married to Miss Gay. A better match there could not be. They both pull one way, but unfortunately the wrong one. Rumour says they are extravagant. Tom is at Westminster School. He has not distinguished himself in any particular study, unless it be boating. They say he would have won in the last race had he not broken his skull. A mishap that sadly terrified Mrs. Brown, for the note intimating the catastrophe said nothing about the skulls being more wooden than her son's. Mr. and Mrs. Brown are really very happy. Victoria and Albert are now united. The party wall is removed. Mr. B. has retired from business, not even discounting bills. He does not go to the city now. Or at least, if he does, it is behind Mr. Strap, who makes an important coachman, having filled out amazingly. Maybe thinking he who drives fat cattle should himself be fat, for the bays are too corpulent to kick and take the journeys at their own pace. John Brown, private, now keeps a public house, the Brown Arms, the rampant locomotive, noted Brown Stout House, at the corner of Brown Terrace. It was a beer shop when John first took it, but he has since obtained a license, and married Mary, the housemaid. Mr. Brown is notorious for keeping up the festive Christmas season. He now makes it a rule to invite only those he loves or respects. Not because they are well-to-do in this world, but because he likes or admires them, seeming fully assured of time's progress, and that,
Christmas comes but once a year. End of Christmas Comes But Once a Year by John Leighton. Recording by Ruth Golding. Christmas 2010.